Hey, Living for Food listeners, coming to you live from the beautiful Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. I am so excited to bring you an amazing guest this week. I know there's been a little bit of a break, but I have so many amazing conversations scheduled, and I'm really excited to get those out there. So with that being said, my next guest you may recognize from Next Level Iron Chef, some other shows on Food Network, or you may recognize her as the most powerful woman in Manhattan, which she was named at one point. I spoke with the lovely Donatella to chat everything from her bringing burrata to America to getting her advice on being a confident businesswoman and going full force into anything you want to do. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I think you all will too. It's so food-oriented, but also provides so much advice for those who are looking to break their way into the restaurant industry, but also just any industry in general. So please join me in welcoming the lovely Donatella.
One, two.
It's so great to meet you. It's been a few weeks since I've recorded, so I'm excited to chat.
Too. Get back in the swing.
I am. Yeah, I'm excited because I was looking through your background, and it's just incredible, too. I literally could have probably had you on here for like 4 hours, but I'll spare you that.
I get exhausted reading my bio sometimes. I'm like, okay.
I did too. I was like, I thought I did a lot. And then I was looking at, oh my gosh, you really killed it on everything. But I would love to get into your food background first, kind of get to know you a little bit. I did a lot of research, and I know you grew up in Long Island.
Yes.
Being in the food business runs in your family. Your father was a first generation immigrant from Italy who worked way up to opening a restaurant. Tell me about your father's influence elevating Italian American cuisine and how you kind of perceived that motivation growing up.
Sure. That's a great question. Thank you. Because during that time, so my dad came from Naples, the birthplace of Neapolitan pizza, and my mother came from Puglia, which is the heel of the
pizza. Yes, I've yet to be there, but I would love to go to Puglia.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's considered like the Hamptons of Italy, like the still untouched, undiscovered. So I was fortunate to spend every summer, 3 months growing up in Italy and then, in Long Island. And my mom's family still had like farmland, so we would, before all the strict protocols, we would bring jugs of that olive oil home on the airplane with us. And so I spent my summers like on the farm and, seeing them make oil for the family. And my father, really, there was a big disconnect between the food that I ate at home, because my mother came to this country when she was 12, and she was kind of ripped from her family. She was one of 12. It was during the war, and her connection to staying Italian was just like we ate as if we lived in Italy. So I don't think I had butter until I was 15, because in the South there's no butter. Yeah. So, but there was definitely a disconnect between, much like, Chinese food here is different than Chinese American food. So back then the restaurants were more, checkered tablecloth, spaghetti, meatball, big portion type of food. And it didn't really reflect the elegance of the Italian food that I think we grew up with. So my dad, which is really sweet, he was one of the first waiters, along with Ciro Maccioni, Tony May. They were all waiters at Delmonico's, the famous restaurant that just reopened that I'm really good friends with Max Tucci. And my dad, he got a lot of interviews from my dad because my dad was there for that whole entire time. And he wanted to bring the different version of and perception to the American clientele. So his first restaurant was open, La Tavernetta in Long Island. And then his first foray into New York City was Lello's, which is his nickname for Raffaele. And it's on 54th between Park and Madison. It's now Cellini's, which is my brother's restaurant. So it's been in the restaurant. I mean, I have photos. I must have been 6 or 7, and it's been in the family for some 40 years. And that's, but he really took you know, back then it was like Le Cirque, which was more that French style of service, but he brought that elegance to Italian cuisine. But it was still a more northern type of cuisine. Yes. But I grew up, basically, his first restaurant was in Woodmere, and my house was next to the restaurant. So my backyard was the kitchen. Yeah. You know, I grew up around, but unlike my brother, my dad did not want me to go in the restaurant business. Many immigrants back then, they said, like, you could do whatever you want as long as you study, get perfect A's, and become a lawyer or a doctor.
Yeah.
So my brother was groomed for the business, and although I was around the restaurant, he never really wanted me to work in the restaurant. I did
one
summer.
Was that a woman versus male kind of thing, or?
So I think it was, in that generation, many of the men were very, like, get married and da da da. No, my father was always be independent, but I think the life of the restaurateur, mm-hmm. he was just like, it wasn't like today, the Food Network and the, you know, the chefs. It was a very hard, very physical place. And I think that it came from the aspect of I have to work like with my hands so that my children don't have to. And the American dream was like lawyer, doctor. Okay. So he did say, you could be whatever you want as long as you become a lawyer first. And so I became a lawyer and I worked for about 4 months. And I was living above my brother's restaurant in a studio apartment on 54th between Park and Madison. And I came back one day and I was just like, my brother was seating people and it was raining and the host didn't show up. And I just kind of like got up and I was eating for free, of course. And I just got up and started helping him. And that's when I had like my aha moment, because I was like, okay, you know, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer because my parents are like, you want to be a lawyer, you want to be a lawyer. And then I'm like, I really liked the study of law and it served me well. And I think it gave me an advantage in this field, but the practicality of what that meant, I did not want to be a lawyer and I knew it. And I had that aha moment. I was like, not only am I going to, I should be doing this because I feel alive, but I'm going to do it better than my dad and my dad. Because I was just
a little competition, you know, there.
Yeah, friendly competition. So I told my dad and he was like, okay, I just spent a lot of money on her education. But he was also like, if this is what you want to do, then you got to go all in. And, you know, most of my friends were partying post college and law school, but I just had this thing that I wanted to do it. So I found this failed location on 52nd between 3rd and 2nd. And I had a little bit of money and a loan. And I opened up my first restaurant, Bellini, which was, it became a very local, successful place. And it was really built on, you know, tremendous customer service and just my drive to make it successful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I do want to get there in a second because I have
to. Yeah, sorry.
No. I want to fill some gaps there. That was a wonderful explanation, though. So your brother, was the restaurant closed originally and then he revamped it, or he kind of just turned it around?
No. So it was Lello Restaurant, which my dad had for 25 years. He also opened Spartolotti's on 52nd between Madison Park, which is now Fresco's. The Scottos own it, that location.
Yeah.
And then he wanted to, you know, help my brother and set him up. Mm-hmm. And so they revamped it and closed it. And it's now called Cellini, which is a more rustic style place. And it's been there for 25 years now. So people, it's like a local haunt that everyone loves and knows. And I'm very proud of my brother.
I've heard of it. Yeah. I'm from Connecticut. So I was going into New York all the time for work and stuff. So I've heard of it, but I've yet to visit. So I'll be back.
Yeah, you have to go.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I have a house in Connecticut on Candlewood Lake.
Oh, really? Yeah, I'm from Monroe area. So like Fairfield County and everything.
Yeah. I went to Fairfield U.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that. That's amazing. Yeah, that's a good school.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, I went to UConn, so I completed all my education in Connecticut, and now I'm in California, so I called it out.
California.
Yeah, I am. But I want to kind of reel it back a little bit, because I know you were traveling to Italy as a child. You mentioned you brought olive oil home, which also I literally do every time I go there, and I stuff Parmesan cheese in my back and all the things. But you were spending summers with your grandparents in a village in southern Italy. What's one of your fondest memories of, in terms of food and cooking, that you remember when you think of those kind of times?
Sure, those beautiful sense memories. Yeah. I'm going to point out three. One was, there are these things called fioroni, which are like figs, but they're like this big. Mm-hmm. And they would only come like once a year. And I would ride my bicycle when they were ready to the farm. And they were like the size of like these big pears. And it was just like the most delicious, like it was like eating candy. And I was waiting for that, the seasonality of something like that. Also learning how to make orecchiette and all these handmade pastas.
I just did that a few months.
They do it like a mile a minute. And I remember my mom did not like homemade pasta because she was forced to eat so much as a child. And also apparently she didn't have the hands for it. So like my aunts had to, you know, test if they were going to, I was worthy of being taught. And they said I had warm hands and they taught me how to make it. And they were just, those memories just are so special. And then my third sense memory was my first bite of Neapolitan pizza.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, so, and my father, Naples. Mm-hmm. And I just remember like, oh my God, like this is what pizza is supposed to taste like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not all the.
You know, like I still remember, I don't know how old I was, but I was like, wow, one day, you know, and later I, you know, became obsessed with it and opened one of the first Neapolitan pizza places. But I just have those sense memories of that pizza. And,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I was just mesmerized by, you know, the food in general and how everything tasted like. A tomato tasted like a tomato. It was like tasting not only the different foods that you didn't find in America, but the foods that you found in America on a daily basis just had a tomato tasted like a tomato.
Yeah, I know. I know.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
I do. It's like night and day, honestly. It's like, it's all the stuff and preservatives and all the thing that gets.
Yeah. And my stomach would feel better. And like, I never had an issue with weight growing up, but every summer, it's not like I wasn't a sweets person, but every night I would eat ice cream gelato. We would go in the town, but I'm like, I'd always show up like 6 pounds lighter, and I definitely ate more. It's just the food, how it reacts to your body. It was just,
it is. And you just like feel a swollen, and it just is. Yeah. It's just so much better. That happens to me. I was in Sicily with my sister and back in April, but those sense memories too, like even my first cannoli in Sicily, like there's certain memories and tastes that just stick in your mind forever.
Yeah.
I had an asparagus flan in Milan, which was one of the crazier kind of things I've tried, or more unique, I guess, not necessarily crazy, but, and I still remember what it's like. So it's interesting how our brain kind of holds
totally
things so many years after, and now with how it's influenced your career going forward.
Do you know that cartoon, Ratatouille? Did you ever see it?
I have. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know the scene of the critic where he like tastes this, and then all of a sudden he's like a child.
It
pictures that sense memory. Like he was like, this is what it's like. It really takes you back. The smells, like my mother's town is near Altamura, which is famous for their focaccia. And I remember just like walking around and like you smell the bread. Mm-hmm. And these bread ovens were from like the 1400s. Like there's so much history, and you're like, you eat it and you're like, oh my God.
That's the thing, so is that you don't have to overcomplicate it. It's the simplicity. No. That's the beauty of Italian food.
Yeah. That it's all ingredient first, seasonality, respecting the ingredient, and like then leaving it alone if you can.
Right, right. And then, so were you cooking while you were in college and law school and all of that?
No. So, well, first of all, I loved to cook growing up, but I'm left-handed. And I know, as if like I'm a criminal.
Yeah. Oh, yikes. I got to kick you off.
Every time I would go to my mom, I'm like, I want to, you know, like my twins do that now. Mm-hmm. And I would do it, and she's like, you're doing it wrong, because it looked funny to them.
Okay.
So I was always kicked out of the kitchen. Always.
That's so interesting. That's a new
one. Yes. I was always kicked out of the kitchen. And then when I opened up Bellini, I opened up more in terms of front of house. Okay. And I had an understanding of food, but where I parted from my father and really what became my signature was I kept saying to my father, I was like, Dad, why are we making food? Why aren't we introducing recipes that we eat at home? Like, this is going to sound funny to you, but broccoli de Rop was never found in restaurants back then. No one ate broccoli Rop.
Oh, interesting.
Burrata. I was the first person to bring, I have an article about burrata, right? So everything
was
like,
you were the first person to bring burrata here. Burrata.
I have an article about it. Yeah. And whoa, burrata was from Puglia. And I'm like, Dad, this stuff is amazing. Like, no, the people don't understand it. They're not going to understand it. And I'm like, no, we need to bring our regional cuisine.
Yeah.
And I think because I was, you know, I had more formally educated, and I think I had a natural understanding of like press and marketing. I'm like, well, if you explain it to them and then they try it.
Right.
And then it gets written about. And I really started to become known because I started to create a very specific regional Neapolitan cuisine, where right now everything is regional. Like there's, you know, a restaurant that's, but back then it was just like Italian, and it was more like these classic Italian. If you look at old menus back then, it was very, you know, like chicken marsala, chicken, you know, it wasn't like there was not unique ingredients.
Was it still Americanized, like the spaghetti and meatballs and the chicken?
It was, but it was more elevated. So my dad did a more elevated, refined version.
Okay.
But it was still Americanized. Like I'll give you the caprese, which was like sliced dry mozzarella with tomatoes, you know? Where now it's like, you know, fresh mozzarella. And like, I'm a cheese expert because I'm like,
oh, please, me too.
I'm a brand ambassador for Galbani. Galbani, I'll tell you, it's not a plug. It just happened organically, but I'm obsessed with cheese.
Me too.
And when I opened up my restaurant, Prova, my first quick casual pizza restaurant in Grand Central, I did a blind tasting of cheeses. And this is great because it goes back to sense memory. And I just said, give me the, you know, the top cheeses that people use. And I did it. And I selected Galbani. I hadn't heard of Galbani here. I had heard of
the Grand Central one you opened in 2015 around.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then when they found out that I was using the cheese, they were like, oh, we're doing a campaign. We would love to talk to you. And then I called my parents up and I was like, Mom, have you heard of this company called Galbani? And they're like, Galbani, of course. Galbani vuol dire fiducia. So it was like the craft of Italy. So it's very well known. It's like the number one cheese of Italy. So it made sense because the taste was familiar to me because I grew up eating it. She's like, you ate it all the time in Italy. So I was like, oh, that's why. I was like, this is the taste that I want. So it came back, and that's how that whole relationship started, from my sense memory and, you know, the quality of the milk and the process. And, you know, I've been to the factories. It's fascinating to watch.
It is. It is so fascinating. Well, first I need to thank you for bringing that to the U.S. because burrata is my like favorite thing in the entire world.
And it's from Puglia. So.
Right. Yeah. I lived in Florence for a little bit. So I was abroad and then I went back with my best friend and then we lived there. So then I got to go to a ton of different cities, but Puglia is still one that I keep missing, but I got to go back. I know you mentioned you were at your brother's restaurant, then you started kind of hosting and that's where it kind of clicked for you.
Yeah.
That switch of clarity, was there any hesitation for you in saying, hey, I'm dishing the lawyer thing and just going for it? Or no, because you already had your dad and brother kind of in that business?
You know, they weren't like, remember, I grew up in it. So I knew, right. I understood the reality of it. I had no like glamorous versions of it.
Yeah.
And I worked like a couple of summers in college as the cashier, because remember back then there was no online, everything was like, yeah. you had to translate the hieroglyphics of the waiter's pad. It was kind of an instantaneous moment for me, where I started, like, I was doing the law for a few months and I'm like, I'm just not, like, I'm not seeing this. I'm not inspired by it. And then you think about, like, well, you have to become, what's the goal? I was always very ambitious and like, is the goal partner? But if I don't want that, what am I doing? And I've spoken to a lot of women and I'm a professional speaker at certain items about that moment. And I think people have a lot of fear. And I was, look, you're not going to believe this because of what I do, but I had like a tremendous fear of public speaking, like crippling. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But when I did too, believe it or not.
Yeah, like crippling. I mean, okay. Like not a joke.
Would you get like sweaty and nervous or like you just couldn't even speak?
I'll get to that in a second.
Okay. Yeah.
But when it came to knowing what I wanted, I was not afraid to try anything. Like I wasn't afraid of it not working out, I guess. And I just didn't even think it was an option. And I knew it was so guttural, like it was so like obvious that I was just like, wait a second, like this feels like, and I grew up in the restaurant. Like my happiest moments were around food. My happiest moments was when I was sick from school and I got to go eat the family meal with the, you know, the waiters in the back. And I grew up in the kitchens and we spoke about food. You know, my family, food is an art form. Italians, like we just love to feed people.
Mm-hmm.
We love
to talk about food.
You grew up on pastina.
I did. Whenever I was sick, my dad would just make it. And he didn't even do much to it, just butter. And I'm like, still, it's my comfort.
Butter and cheese? Are you kidding me?
Butter and cheese. Yeah, that's it.
I think that, you know, my dad worked a lot, except Sundays. Sundays was religious, where we would eat at home. And you know, we with the big relatives and Christmas and Easter. And, you know, it was a time of family gathering and my summers, which were so special. Mm-hmm. That I really do love to feed people. And I express my love, and that's how my mother expressed her love. So it was automatic. Of course, there was fear, of course. And I remember, like, I just started, like, I was doing it. I was telling my dad, I started looking and researching, and I found this location that had failed many times, like 12 times. But I remember when I got the lease, I was in court. And I was like, I remember the moment I got it, I was just like, and I was like, I knew I made the right decision.
Now you can do it.
Like now I knew, you know, and you can make wrong decisions in life, but like, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And then I became obsessed with it. Like all my friends were like, how come you don't want to go out? I'm like, no.
Well, you kind of can't either. When you're starting a restaurant, you have to be obsessed with it because I feel like
You do have to be obsessed. And you know, this is going to be hard for you because so much has changed. But when I was there, there was not one woman that worked for me. There was nobody in fine dining. There were no women servers. So Jean-Georges was the first one to change that. And you would start seeing the change. So I was this like weird unicorn. Like, who's this girl? First of all, I was 26 and I looked like I was 22. And I was an attorney. And now I'm like in a midtown traditional like restaurant. People didn't know how to like what to do with me.
Were you intimidating to the other male? Like, since it's a male dominated field and you had the business education, did you?
Was I intimidated? I mean, like, this was before the Me Too movement, so no one was careful about the way they spoke. And I was just like, you should see, I should find old reviews about how, like, they would just talk about me in ways that are like, they can't do that stuff anymore. They're like, oh, I remember the first Zagat review was like, you got to go for the hot owner and you do this or that. Or when I started becoming popular, it was all because she's hot or she's this or she's that. Oh yeah, it was so like, but I was never offended by it. I was just like, bring it on. I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. I remember I didn't know how to dress because there was no real dress code for a woman restaurateur. So I was wearing these legal suits because I was like, I'm a lawyer now, you know.
Blazer and some trousers.
Yeah, and I'm like, this isn't me. And then they would like start, and then this is before I, you know, had a TV personality. I started to do TV to get people in the door because no one was coming in, right? And I had to pay rent. And so I started doing local TV, and it was just like, I would be throwing up right before I went on TV. You know, I was just like really bad. And I, thank God it was like,
those were big shows too. Those were like,
well, it wasn't at first, but local at first. When I opened up, and then I remember as I became more developed and I opened up my second restaurant, I was like, you know, if people are going to say I'm too sexy, I'm too conservative, she doesn't look, then they start saying, oh, she didn't look like she did on TV. She did, everything was about me, my physicality. And I was like, you know what? I can be strong. I can be smart. I can be feminine, and I can own. And I saw my femininity as a strength. And as an owner, I was like, I'm opening up this like fine dining Italian restaurant. So I'm going to wear designers. I'm going to wear Donatella Versace. I was just like, you know, I'm going to be me. Like, I'm going to start, like, I'm not going to fit your mold anymore.
Because it's like, do you unsexy yourself, or do you make yourself like sexier to, like, it's just like, you can't win. So
you can't win. I was sexy because I was, you know, I was sexy because I was young. And and I just said, instead of trying to like fit, I always wanted to be appropriate. So like, if, you know, if it's a pizza place, it can be casual. And if I'm opening up a fine dining restaurant, whether it was David Burke and Donatella or Adona that I opened up, I was like, let me own this. Like, let me own who I am. And, you know, my revenge was not going away. Then I got the James Beard Award, and then we opened up Anthos, which had a Michelin star. So I was like, my revenge was just, I didn't go away. And then they had a force to be, I was forced to be taken seriously.
That's so impressive.
And then they had to tear me down.
Of course they do, because there's nothing that people love more than a rise and fall story.
Yeah. I wasn't ready for that, because before I was like the little, like, I think the press, you know, took me in because I was just so like wide-eyed and excited. And like, they're like, I didn't know how to be political, and I was so sheltered and naive from Long Island. So they're like, they loved me. And then all of a sudden I made the mistake of becoming too successful in their eyes.
Yep. Yeah, because I think in the journalism field too, it was definitely male dominated.
I mean, it was all male dominated.
Yeah, all of it was.
It was like, I was like, they did a story on me because I was the girl. I was like the only one. And there were the only females literally that were, you know, owners was Lydia Bastianich and
I love her.
And one other woman. And they were not bad, but they like had no interest in, like, I had no mentors, or they saw me as competition. Probably I was young, so I had no one to speak to.
That must have been incredibly isolating.
Very. I think I had my dad, and he was amazing, but boy, he was tough on me. But you know, he made me who I am. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He made me who I am.
I feel like a lot of people in that position would have been easy for them to quit or not to use the isolation as power. And it seems like you developed the confidence throughout the time, and I kind of almost fueled your fire a little bit to be like, hey, screw you guys, I'm gonna do this, and I'm gonna be successful, and I'm gonna be like Lydia.
The more they said no or failure, the more I was like, okay,
watch how
it was awesome, naturally resilient. And that's before then what happened with the food part. Then I went to culinary school, because that was another chapter.
Right. I want to get there too as well. But I read that you handwrote letters to your customers in your first restaurant, which...
How did you hear that?
I told you I did research. I feel like that's such a gift to make people feel special like that, because I know... when I go to a restaurant, or when I know the owner and they just know you immediately, they recognize your face, or even if they don't recognize you and you're a first time customer, but they just go that extra mile to speak to you, that really does make the difference. Do you feel like that's kind of what catapulted your first restaurant?
1,000,000%. I think my biggest talent when I first opened was I wasn't the chef, for sure. I understood about good service, but I had a unique talent for making everyone feel very special. And I loved people, and you know, it became a very, and then people started rooting for me, right? Because they wanted to see me win. You know, it was really hard when there's like nobody walking in. So when that one person comes in, it's empty, so they don't want to come back psychologically. But if I sat with you and said, this is my first restaurant, and like that, and you're a girl, and I brought you burrata, which you haven't seen before, and this is my food, then you sent everyone. And then what I would do was I had these cards that said, thank you for coming. And I would always wrote a note to like about what your name was, like something that you had. So it was personalized too, like, I hope you enjoyed blah, 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 and da, da, da. And so it really became, it was like such an eclectic group. And then right around me was like British Assembly and then this law firm that had like a lot of celebrities. So I remember it became such a, like Mary J. Blige would come all the time.
No way.
Yeah. And we're like almost the same age. She's like maybe a year older now, okay. But I remember when she came in and like she would tell me stories, and I'm like this sheltered girl from Long Island, and this is like she's like in the hood and da, da, da. And like she's like telling me stuff that I can't repeat because it's like gossip.
So fair.
She was so, I'm like, and then she started coming. She always wanted to come, and she had her spaghetti with her shrimp and her spicy, and I made it for her, and I had an ability to connect with everyone. And then Walter Cronkite, who lived right down the block, came to my restaurant. And I'll never forget when I got Crane's 40 Under 40. He sent a fax with his wife, and he's like, do you think me and the missus, you're going to have room for us now? So proud of you. And
I'm
like,
wow.
And like, I knew that he had trouble hearing. So I put him in the corner, and I knew that people would come up to him, and he didn't want them to know that like he was getting slow because it was a hearing thing. So like I understood the nuances of people.
Yeah.
And I never forget one night, and the police commissioners always came. I always took care of the cops outside. I always fed the cops.
That makes a big difference. Always. That's really sweet.
You do, because one day you need them.
Yeah,
too.
One day if you have a fire or something, you need them to come.
I always felt like I always treated, whether you were the celebrity or the female diner alone, I always like treated everyone special. So then it became a place where people on business that were single, they always knew to come because I felt them. So I remember one night, this is a great story, like I had like the mob in one corner, the police commissioner in another. Mary J. Blige in one, and Walter. And here's the thing. The waiters are like, Donatella, they want you to take the order. So I had to go. And at one point, it's like the mob and the police commissioner. And I'm like, they're both waiting for me. And I look at the mob guy. I'm like, where do you want me to go?
What do I do?
And he's like, go ahead. Go over there. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, don't draw attention to us. Go to the police.
You had a job. But yeah, it became a problem because everyone's like, is Donatella there tonight? Is Donatella there tonight?
Okay.
And if I wasn't there, they didn't want to come. So I was like, how do I, like, I became very successful at 28. It was packed, but I was like, okay, what's my next goal?
You can't split yourself in two, you know?
Yeah. So I wanted to train people to have that affect and like the door, which is completely lost today, you know, with online reservations. And I was the first one to adapt online reservations, actually. There was an article in Forbes about it.
Really?
It was like Food Line right before Open Table. And where there was an article, it was like, everyone's like, no one's going to want this. It's, you know, people said it's terrible. And people are, I'm like, no, I wanted it because I was so good at tracking habits. That I was like, this is going to be great information. I was like, I don't think people are going to use it to book a reservation. Like back then.
Yeah, but at least information.
But at least I have information.
Oh,
yeah. And now we get to a point where no one wants to talk to anybody.
I know. It's like, sometimes I find myself nervous to call a doctor or something. And I'm like, what am I doing? Why? Because I talk to people for a living. So I'm like, why is it when you just have to call or do something, it kind of changes.
And I always say the best restaurant that most people will say is the one where they know your name. So I do think that obviously, you know, food and service has to be good, but it is really nice to have that like feeling.
It is. Yeah. It is. There's one Italian restaurant I wrote about for Eater a few months ago, and we text like on and off, but he makes everyone there feel special, and the customers have been there for years and years and years. And I was like, how has no one noticed this restaurant or written about it? It's just like that hard work. I feel like sometimes can get a little bit lost just because we have so many restaurants now and so many people wanting to start things. And
well, that's not the only reason. You have to, like, it's become like, it makes me sad, like New York too. It's like when I was younger, you had all these like talented young chefs that could open a hole in the wall. It's become like, if you're not big corporate, you can't survive. And then you have to use these platforms and you have to pay all these fees. Otherwise you're not even like, you're not even on the radar.
Yeah, it's the influencer culture. You need to have.
And oh yeah. Oh, by the way, and then everyone's a critic today, you know, and like Yelp, which, oh my God, I hate Yelp. I hate Yelp because.
I can imagine.
I hate Yelp because you don't have to verify. You don't have to actually come there. So Google, you have to be there. So when I opened up my restaurant in Miami, Noma Beach, I had a really hard time because the former owner was this Miami female beloved chef who's a very talented chef. And she left. I had nothing to do with it. And I took the restaurant over months later, but the community was angry. So I literally would get like tons of Yelp reviews of people that didn't come in that are like, it's not
it's bad.
Her. Like, and it's like bad, 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 bad. And it kills you. And you can't change the algorithm and then you can't do anything. And it's just like, it's really frustrating for restaurateurs to have to deal with that. It's really, I think, I don't think it should be allowed. I think reviews should be allowed if you show up and they should have a verification.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Not necessary.
Actually, I never really realized that distinction. That's really good to know because I mean, just as I'm writing restaurants and always looking places, I'm always looking at reviews, but
I
that's a really good distinction.
And it really bothers me. Like, so my Open Table, which is the platform I use, you know, like my ratings are like 4.8 out of 5 and Google's very high and Yelp is like low because, you know, it's like all this junk that I can't even.
It's also like a lot of that is based on, I was talking to one chef about this, like, on my podcast a while back, and he was saying like sometimes people just have a bad day on their own and then they come in and try your food and they just kind of project, like even if your food is good, or say they're fighting with their girlfriend or they're like just got laid off or something, their food is good, but and then like maybe one thing ticked them off and then it gets a bad review, you know.
I mean, do you want to know the real truth too on top of it? If I have 200 people come in a day, the 190 people that have a great meal, maybe two will write a review. I write reviews now because I feel like I have to do it because I'm like, the good people don't write reviews. It's only the people that are angry that will write a review. And there's a whole subset of people, and us as restaurateurs know this, and we try and mark them, that go around and purposely eat a bunch of food and then will complain and want it for free and say, well, I'm put a review up and say, if you don't pay me or refund me everything, I'll do this. And this is like,
oh, common. That's absurd.
Oh, but it's common.
Really? That's insane. I'm sorry.
100%.
Then don't eat out if you don't want to pay for it.
But like, and they basically blackmail restaurateurs. It's common.
You know, I believe it's common, but I just would never even think to do that. So I'm just like, that is just so screwed up.
It's so mean, right?
Yeah, it's because you guys work so hard to like put good food on the table and to like
and it take really it impacts. Like it really impacts, and it's hard like to get those people to get the people that love your restaurant. Can you please write a review? Yes, like you have to ask them 20 times. They finally do, and then like you have one person that will come and like purposely. Yeah.
Right. It's so screwed up. That's LA is having a tough time now from the fires. A lot of people, like the restaurant scene is not a lot of people are eating out. So they're laying off a ton of people. And I'm hoping that'll people will keep eating out and like encourage. So I'm trying to like find restaurants to write about and stuff. But it's just like the scene here is kind of not the best at the moment. So I'm hoping
it's heartbreaking what's going on.
It is. As you got into television, though, was your perception and being a successful woman changing because you started, you were a judge on these shows. You weren't even like a contestant. So
yeah.
People must have really liked you if you were coming back and judging.
Yeah. So when I opened up my second restaurant after Bellini was David Burke and Donatella. And that like catapulted me from a local to like immediate success. Cause it was like the number one rated restaurant in New York. And people didn't know who I was. They thought it was Donatella Versace, the restaurant.
You could take that though.
But I remember there was a producer, Bruce Seidel, a good friend of mine, who came in. He's like, I want you to like judge Iron Chef. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Thank God I was practicing. So I was still nervous, but I was getting better at it. And that opened up a whole new world for me. And not only that, it exposed me to so many great chefs and also to improve my own food. And I saw like people like Bobby and Morimoto as they competed too, they became better. It was really a great time. And I was like the queen of New York because I was like, I couldn't go anywhere without
them. I saw you were the most powerful woman in Manhattan or something magazine named you. Yeah.
I was until they destroyed me. I'm just kidding. It was a beautiful time. I always say that was like the golden age of New York because Giuliani and like when I grew up going to my dad's restaurant, New York was, it was like rough. It was,
bottom of the barrel.
And then when Giuliani and Bloomberg came, they cleaned it up. And I was just like, it was such a magical moment for restaurateurs. There were so many like these amazing restaurants and chefs coming out and like, all the restaurateurs would go out late night and go eat for sushi. And it was just like, I always say it was the golden age and it was really fun. And I loved judging. I became friends with a lot of the media and they'd often ask me to, you know, go out with them. And I'm always on the restaurateur's side. I would always be like, I don't know what you're talking about. So this is how it should be. So write a good thing. It was a really special time. It was a really special time, magical time. And I love it. I still love judging. And I think because I am an attorney, I really like to be, you know, balanced about things. And I remember at one point they started having like a lot of like, you know, they would have the serious judges like me and a few others, but then they would have like some celebrities, like half the time, like a model that wouldn't eat or somebody and the producers or my ear like help them out. Like I'm like, and yeah. I would see Bobby Flay like, really? They don't even know what they're talking about. So I would always balance it out. I'm like, it's not about your preference. It's about objectively speaking.
Right. Yeah.
Is this good? And I know what it's like to be a chef in the kitchen and they work so hard. So for someone to like bake, like I always say, Iron Chef was the most real of all reality TV. I mean, these are chefs that are really good at what they do. They're owners there. Whereas there's nothing wrong with like top chef, they're younger. And it was also about the personality, you know, but when you were on Iron Chef, these were top chefs competing, top chefs.
Intense.
And in that time frame. Now the judging was extended, right? And they edited it out, but like that was a real time clock. Everything was real about it. And so I was like, how can I look at a Morimoto and a Bobby Flay, unless I knew it was like, I know they had to respect me. And I was like, you might've had a bad day, but I can only judge what's in front of me. So they always respected me. And I appreciated that because I respected what they did. And I became a really good judge because I judged more episodes than anyone. Next Iron Chef, Iron Chef America. We did it in Japan. That was amazing.
I saw with Alton Brown. You were with
Alton.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, they should have me back on.
He should. I know.
Right?
I was thinking that. I was like, "Where's your next appearances? Like, what are you going to do? You've been since what?
Exactly. Well, I did take a little hiatus. I moved to Miami a year before the pandemic because I found out I was pregnant with twins.
Awesome.
So I kind of purposely, and then the COVID happened, right? So it was kind of like I took a step back. I did a lot of TV during COVID from my kitchen because like they wouldn't ask many celebrities to do stuff like the Today Show from your kitchen. But I kind of took a step back, but now I'm ready to, my twins are now six and my son is 13 and I'm ready to, you know, get back in the game.
I was literally just in Miami this past weekend, but only for like 2 days.
Because for Sobe?
I was at the food festival and it was fun. I did they have like a foodie con, so all the food influencers and stuff, but then like the big grand tasting. And
well, next time you have to come to my restaurant.
I know. I'm like
in the water. It's so beautiful. Like, it's one of the most beautiful locations. It's like a hidden gem of Miami. It's right in Coral Gables. It's away from the craziness.
Inspired, right?
It's yeah, because, you know, we're on the water. But of course, I have my meatballs.
I know. I need to ask.
March 9th is National Meatball Day. So we're doing this whole, like, and I'm the meatball queen. So I'm adding some edible gold and truffles. I'm just, you know, having a little fun.
Oh, having a little fun with it? Oh my gosh, that's so fun. My younger cousin, he will order meatballs at any restaurant we go to, like any restaurant, no matter where we are. It could be brunch. Like, it doesn't even matter.
I think meatballs is one of the most perfect foods, and it really represents the ethnic culture of where that they're coming from. Like every version has like Sweden and like where, you know,
yeah,
Greek. Like, it really, this is the ultimate comfort food.
What's your secret to the best meatballs? Can you reveal what your secret is?
Sure. I mean, I did win Meatball Madness 2 years in a row, the only
I
one.
Saw.
There is technique involved and practice. So, like, even if you read my recipe, there is, you know, a hand that you develop to it. But for sure, the quality of the meat. And you can use, you know, everyone has a different version. The ones I won were all veal, but I also do all beef and I do a mix. It's more about organic, and the fat ratio and the lean ratio has to be right.
Okay.
And also, you have to use fresh ingredients like fresh garlic, fresh parsley, real Parmigiano cheese as opposed to garlic powder, breadcrumbs. Do not use breadcrumbs.
Why? I do.
No, you have to use rustic Italian bread, like 2-3 days old, and soak it in water or milk. It makes it lighter.
Okay, I believe that. I know I do use it. I use the Italian breadcrumbs.
No.
I'm sorry.
No bueno, as we say in Miami. No. You have to use the bread, and then you have to mix it. You have to mix it but not over mix it. And then I fry them. Sorry, but I not in a deep fryer. The way that my mother did and all Italian moms do, and in good, like, light olive oil. Don't overcrowd it. Put it in a pan, and then you, like, get a golden crust and flip it twice. That's it.
And it's really done. Good. I think my father was saying that my grandmother, because she came from Italy as well, but she would do the raw beef in marinara.
The sauce.
Yeah. Do you prefer to fry it first then versus doing that?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not as healthy, but the real Italians like, because it formulates a crust, and then it creates, but it keeps the locks the moisture inside, and then when the sauce takes it on, I think the mistakes people make is they think like more is better, like they end up like too much in proportion, or like they make bigger, or they try to make it into a meatloaf. I'm like, don't put onions in the meatball, okay?
Oh, like, no, do I that. Do like, that too.
I'm sorry.
No, I need to know. No one's ever told me. So I'm like,
We will do. The next time you come to Miami, I will do a meatball lesson.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to come, and then we can go in the kitchen. You can teach me, because now I'm terrified.
Yeah, and I did there was my mother's, you know, I grew up like most people on a Sunday, they grow up to the smell of bacon and eggs. I grew up with my mom like frying the meatballs and like us stealing it before we went to church when it was just out of the fryer before it went into the sauce. And she was like hitting me with the wooden spoon, like, look,
yeah, don't touch it. My dad just fried eggplant, so we would just smell fried in the morning and it would be.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with fried eggplant. I'm obsessed with, I also had like the top rated eggplant parm in a cast iron pot. That was like another sense memory.
Oh my gosh. Do you ever sleep?
No, I think too much about food.
Okay, but I do too. That's our life.
Yeah, that is our life.
I do want to ask you, going back to the television shows, because you were kind of telling them, you know, you got to be a little unbiased. Did they ever give you feedback or advice on how to be on the television shows or anything about restaurants? Because
I did I think you learn by, well, with TV, I had to, they didn't really give me instruction. They kept asking me to come back. I think they liked my facial expressions and the fact that I was very honest, although they would edit me to be just mean all the time, where it's like, you know, I said like something really nice, but you know how they are. They're like, they take the one thing.
Right.
I would always get when people met, like, you're so much nicer than I thought you'd be. I'm like, okay. I would ask advice all the time. I remember talking to Bobby. He's really, really smart about restaurant advice and deals and all this stuff. And even like dealing with the Food Network or contracts. And he was just like, you know, it's more important what you say no to than what you say yes to, too, because all of a sudden people are throwing a lot of offers and you're excited. So I just being around, you know, chefs and restaurateurs like to share stories. And so just being around them, I learned a ton. And the production team, they were wonderful. Yeah, they were wonderful. Though when they did the re-op of Food Network, they didn't call me back. So,
well, this is your sign. I'll post this and then they'll get right on the phone.
It's okay.
That's okay. Well, now everyone knows that you're not mean in real life.
I am direct though. I think that's that lawyer side of me. And I have to, like, when you're dealing with people dealing at a high level, like, you know, the best chefs, it comes down to a few things, like, cause it's already really good. So it's like, you have to get very like specific about it. I am the main judge at the Pizza Expo, which is coming up in Vegas. Have you been to the Pizza Expo?
No, but I was just in Vegas too. So what am I doing?
I mean, like, Pizza Expo is like, you know how chefs are crazy, but yeah, pizza chefs, it's a cult. Like, they are insane. And then you have all the guys from Naples come.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. You would love Pizza Expo. It is like the event of the year. Okay.
When is April?
It's the third week of March. It's coming up, and I actually helped rewrite all the judging criteria for the judges and help teach how to judge, because there's so many pizza competitions. Like, and I have to eat like 90 pizzas of Neapolitan. And like,
how do you do that? What do you like? Do a palate cleanser in between? What do you do?
It's hardcore, man.
It's
a lot. And sometimes you have to like have more than one bite when it's closed, because you have to like see all the elements. It's a lot.
It's intense.
And I don't spit it out. You know, I don't do that.
No, I don't trust people who do that, honestly. And also, it's gross. No one wants to see you spit it out.
I don't want to do that. It's intense, but it's great. And they're so like pizza chefs.
I believe you. It's an intense.
Oh, they're like crazy. Like, I love them. They're like obsessed. Like, the winner last year, Joe Carlucci, who's a dear friend, who's become a dear friend. He's like, he brings his dough and gets like a room for his dough. Like, he rents
what?
At a certain temperature control. Like, they're obsessed. Like, the bacteria, and like, they have all these things, and they're like, their dough is like their child. It's like their infant. And
that's mother, crazy. And that.
Well, pizza is a science.
Yeah, it is. It is. But that's funny to get it to Doe's hotel room. It's like when you like buckle your something in the car.
Yeah, and no one's allowed to go in the room. Like, he tells them, like, no maids, don't go in the room.
Listen, I get it. If it's your craft, it's your craft. I respect it.
Yeah, hey, he won. It worked.
Yeah. Oh, he won? All right. Well, there you go. That's the key.
One best of the best. Yeah.
So let's talk about what's next for you. You got to go back on the TV, obviously, but you already have a cookbook.
Have a cookbook. I do have another one in the works. It's time.
That's what I was asking.
You know, when I wrote my last cookbook, I was single. I didn't have kids. I wasn't a mom. I was in New York. I had exposure to all the best of the best. So it reflected that, and I loved it. But I think it's really, I get now, as a mother, I constantly get asked, you know, how do you cook for your family? And how do you find ingredients that are, you know, healthy? And like, it's really hard to shop People don't even know how to shop today to find ingredients. Everything is so expensive. And then you have kids, like, it's not like on different schedules. So
different eating habits too.
I'm like, there's so many cookbooks I can write, but I'm just saying, I think I'm listening to what my audience keeps asking me and like how to cook for today's modern lifestyle. Like we have a different life and how to organize it and how to do it. So I'm been working on that. There's definitely going to be a tell all at one point.
Whoa. Okay. That's big. So for the cookbook first, that's going to be family oriented. What kind of recipes are you looking at? Pastas, meatball, obviously. Like what are you gearing towards? Easy weeknight meals, a little more complicated.
Yeah. I feel like it's more going to be not like a traditional recipe book because I don't think that necessarily helps women that don't know how to cook or are uncomfortable in the kitchen. I think it's kind of be like a playbook on how to approach setting up a kitchen, grocery shopping, planning, and then like building on that. So yes, and how to cook certain things and learn like basic techniques to help you cook for your family. And there will be recipes. But yeah, I mean, obviously my background is Italian. Of course, there's going to be pastina. I don't know about you, but besides pastina, the big thing was like, the Italian version of mac and cheese is pasta and peas. Did you have that growing up?
I did. I actually was really picky though. So I didn't like when my food mixed. I was weird. But now I eat literally anything and everything. So
my girl twin, Emma, she nothing up until four, she couldn't tolerate anything that wasn't pureed. Like she didn't want to chew. She couldn't be bothered.
Till four is really, yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, imagine.
Imagine. I get it though. Food, it's tiring. Life is tiring.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to, I don't think that there is a book talking to the women that are not, don't know where to start. And I think that the reality of what it's like in our busy lifestyles to do it. But then there's also like, I kind of love the idea too, like when you occasion to, like if you want to impress someone, like how to do it and like the techniques of, that I always get asked too. So like some women don't like know how much to make for like a holiday meal, 15 people.
I really don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I know people don't. And because I'm in the restaurant, like I understand, for me, it's automatic. So I'm trying to take the things that are automatic and I'm trying to impart that into like a blueprint for women. And so the recipes are important, but I think it's understanding how to like the blueprint and the handbook
for yourself,
how to cook for your family.
Yeah, no, that is extremely helpful. I even have one cookbook Michael Simon wrote a while ago, and
I made Michael Simon an Iron Chef.
You did?
Oh, he was the first one on Next Iron Chef to become Iron Chef. He's the nicest guy in the world.
He is. I've interviewed him a few times, and every time, like, he's just the sweetest guy. And I love his cookbooks, too.
Oh, so good.
A lot of his recipes are so good. The one I was speaking on it's kind of like a playbook, but it really just has, like, what ingredients you'll need for the recipes. It's just very laid out for you, and it's so much more helpful than just, like, grabbing a cookbook and you're like, here's what I need. And
yeah, then
it also racks up in money because you're like, I don't have some of these things. And
exactly.
It's simple, and it just makes my life easier because, you know, I'm not going to cook all these intricate things. And then
I want it to be more like that playbook of, like, this is how you should set up your pantry. And this is what, you know, so that you can make these meals when you didn't have time to, you know, get fresh vegetables or blah, blah, blah. But also to keep in mind, especially as I've gotten older and I'm married to a heart surgeon, that's a big fitness nut.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That, you know, our kids are just have the worst diets in general.
Really?
I see it because I see my friends and the kids when they come over, they are like super, like it's like they eat chicken nuggets and that's it. I'm like, we gotta do better than that, you know?
Yeah. I would ask my husband like a million questions a day if he was a heart doctor. That's funny. All right. So I have a short game for you if you're up for it. I know we're at our hour. So if you have to head out, that's totally fine.
Put my glasses on because I can't see anymore. No, I'm fine. Don't worry. Take your time.
Okay, cool. I normally do this for fun, so it's just like a lightning round, and I'll name some popular Italian foods and beverages, and you're going to tell me if they're a smash or pass or for or against.
Wait, is smash for or against?
Yeah.
Is that like four. The new, how old are you? What are you, like 20? How old are you?
I'm 25.
Like my executive chef at the restaurant, he always comes up with these words. He's like, that's so snatch. I'm like, what?
I say that too.
Okay, so smash.
Okay, I'm even behind now because my 11-year-old cousin sends me stuff and I'm like, oh my gosh, where have I been? She just makes words up. I don't.
Oh yeah, they do. Now I just to embarrass my 13-year-old son who's mortified by me. Every time I like learn a word, I start using it. He's like, Mom, please don't embarrass
yourself. Just stop.
Like,
just stop.
Like, why don't you tell me the tea? And he's like, I'm like, yeah.
Because you said it like that, Mom. So funny. Okay, so we could do four or against. You don't have to do smash or pass.
No, I'm going to do smash or pass.
Okay, so smash is four, pass is pass. The first one, obvious, Aperol Spritz.
Smash.
Obviously.
It's like my favorite. How did you know?
That
and a Negroni.
I would drink one every single day.
Totally.
I should. Have you ever had a violet, like a lavender spritz?
Yes.
You don't like them?
I have to be in the mood for them. I actually made a violet cupcake once on HSN. It was a whole bloom cupcake collection that I did, and I thought it was really cool. Beautiful color. I have to be in the mood for it. I have to be in the mood for it. It's kind of perfumey, like in a way. Like, I have to be in the mood for it. It's like rose.
It is. No, it definitely is. Because Aperol is a little bit more bitter and tangy versus.
I like bitter. I'm not a sweets girl.
I'm a sweets person. But I can't find a violet spritz anywhere but Florence. I only had it in one restaurant, and I've never seen it anywhere else.
Okay, so I'm going to make one for you when you come.
Okay, thanks. Meatballs and that. That's important. The second one, I'm sure you've maybe heard of this, but putting cocoa powder in ragu.
I have heard of it. I haven't done it, but I have heard of it. And I think it probably gives this earthy thing and a sweetness that, as long as it's unsweetened, right? Cocoa powder?
Yeah, unsweetened. And then it would like balance out maybe the acidity of the tomatoes. Mm-hmm. But a chef at Italy told me once that he does that. And I was like, huh.
Yeah, I could see that. That's interesting. I've heard of it. And I think it also, like you said, it depends on the quality of the tomatoes you get. You have to like learn how to balance things out. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then the third one, smash or pass, penne alla vodka pizza. Have you seen those?
I have not seen them.
People putting pasta on pizza.
Well, it's like when remember when the hot dog and french fries were?
Yeah.
I would say pass.
I agree. I think it's just carbs on carbs, but it doesn't add much flavor. It just takes away, I think.
Yeah, I think that feels like gluttonous, like just more is more. I'm like the big meatball. No.
Yeah, agreed.
Although pasta and potatoes doesn't work, but totally does. Pasta and patate. It's a classic Italian. Yeah, but I don't like the wet, floppy pasta on the pizza.
Me either. They do mac and cheese pizzas now too. And that's just like, that ruins it for me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right. That was my last one for you. But my final question that I ask every single guest, if there is a cooking utensil or appliance that you think everyone should splurge on, what would it be and why?
Appliance? I mean, if you're going to splurge on one thing, it should be incredible quality knives and sharpening tools, if it's one. And then I would say as a tool, I'm obsessed with the air fryer. I mean, I wasn't an appliance girl, but
I'm surprised by that.
Well, what happened was I became the brand ambassador for Philips during the pandemic. And then my kitchen, I redid my kitchen and it lasted like 4 months later. So I had all these air fryers and air fryers, like I don't use an air fryer for what most people use it for like frying without the fat. You think about what people don't realize and why it's become the biggest thing. It's kind of like having a very powerful countertop oven. So I think for people that are intimidated by cooking, or if you are like single or a couple, there's less cleanup, or older people, it's amazing for things because, And when you have like, when you're a mom that has kids, like, I don't want the chicken. I don't want the fish. I don't want, like, I literally was having like for 3 months,
that was me.
I was cooking with a steamer and air fryers because I didn't have my oven yet. So
right.
I became like, that becomes a great last minute thing. And it's also great for heating up chicken nuggets and heating up frozen food, much better than a microwave.
Not heart healthy, but it gets it done.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that.
Funny. Okay, I missed a question I did want to ask you, so I lied. This is my final
question.
That's
fine. I'm good. I have time.
Just because, you know, like Women's Month is coming up next month, and you're such a prolific entrepreneur, and I feel like you could really help other female entrepreneurs out there who are listening. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to start a business, what is some advice you have or something that tends to get overlooked by beginner entrepreneurs, culinary stars, really, really any field?
I women come up to me all the time and ask these questions.
I'm sure.
Well, first of all, women that work for companies, it's different than entrepreneurs. Women that work for companies, I find that they are often upset because they feel like they're not being appreciated or valued the way they should. And I said, it's a business. If you don't ask, you don't get. And a lot of times they're upset because their peers are advancing, and I'm an owner of a business. So if you worked for me, I'm not going to like volunteer to give you a raise.
Right.
But if you can say, hey, like, I think women were like looking for that acknowledgement and looking for the, like, you did a great job, but you don't ask, you don't get. And so I always encourage women to not be afraid to speak and not to be afraid to know their value and own their value. And I always say, did you ask for the raise? Did you say, you know, okay, you can't, but what are the things they need to do? And then follow up. And then if they don't and you feel like you're in that wrong environment, then start looking somewhere else and keep moving on. I think a lot of women are afraid to know their value, own their value, and ask for it. I think that's a common theme for people that work in companies. I think that women that are owners and entrepreneurs in general and small business owners, they often focus on what they're good at, but you have to also be mindful of what you're not good at. For example, if you're not good at numbers or finances and you just don't like it, which I didn't, I like to create. I didn't like mm-hmm. to deal with numbers.
I can't stand that either.
Don't ignore it. Find somebody that's really good at it that you trust, because if you ignore it, you're not going to do well. Like, in a way, like, thank God I faced my fear with public speaking, because it opened up a whole world for me, right? So I faced it and do the uncomfortable. So don't ignore what's uncomfortable, like, and be honest and have an audit and be really honest about what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and find a mentor, and don't be afraid to look for one and to ask for advice. And people like me, we'd love to, you know, mentor and give advice. And I think it's really important and to know your value. And, you know, there's no crying in baseball. I always say, and I always got those questions about the Me Too and the blah, 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 which I think was an important movement. I'm not diminishing it, but
yeah.
I mean, I could have made millions of dollars on stuff for the shit that I went through. But like, the truth is, I never saw myself as a victim, and I never allowed myself to, I was an owner of a business, but I was always just like, I'm going to, like, no matter what, I was just like, no, come on, bring it. And it made me stronger and made me resilient. I mean, I definitely didn't have a seat at many tables because I was a female, but I didn't really focus on that. I focused on all the unique opportunities that became because of my femininity, and I always saw it as a strength. But, and I also have to say, just be kind to your fellow women. I think that there's this jealousy and competitiveness that occurs, especially between older and younger women. Like, I wish I had a mentor. Like, I love, you know, grooming young talent, and I would love women to groom, or men, but I'm just saying it's not the way to look for that. And I'm going to say this final thing. I really hate, for women like me that, like, you know, we were trailblazers and we did all this stuff, and I see it, especially because I have a young daughter, I hate the over-sexualization of women that they do to themselves on social media, I think it's terrible. Like, so we've come so far to not be objectified and to be taken seriously, and all you're selling is objectification. Like, you're in the business of, like, whatever business you are, but you're wearing, like, a bikini. Like, who are you? Because social media is work. I'm sorry. It's your life. You can't, it's not like, I'm an interior designer, but let me just be naked and walk on the beach and, like, show my, you know, it makes me sad, actually.
I have, like, conflicting views on that, because I feel like we could take advantage of those things in order to, because, you know, society has put that on us so much, the over sexualization, that it's like, if you can make money off of it, I guess do it. But then on the other side, it's like,
did society put it, or did we, are we taking what society gives us and saying that's our only value, so we can do that?
Yeah, that's the caveat. I mean, yeah. It's like, are we are over sex, because I still get comments to this day in journalist rooms or whoever from men who are older than me saying, you know, whatever they've said to you, similar things. But I don't know. I'm really conflicted on that, because I feel like we could lean into it to make money. That's just the way it is. But at the same time, it's like,
Listen, if you're a swimsuit model, it's appropriate. Yeah. Okay. If you're like, and I'm not saying that the fact that I was, you know, beautiful and wearing Versace and like that, my beauty and femininity 100% helped me. Okay.
Right.
And it's not, but it wasn't the reason I became successful. I didn't get a James Beard. I became successful because I was knocked down. And every time I was knocked down, I came back up and I worked harder than anyone else. That doesn't mean that beauty and femininity can't be, there's a difference between that and then just like overtly sexualizing everything.
Right.
As a career person. I mean, I'm not like criticizing. I'm just saying what you're telling me, what makes me sad. It makes me sad to see that. And I don't care what a woman says. I saw somebody, I'm not going to name who it was, a celebrity, saying that she was criticized for her OnlyFans page and blah, blah, blah. Mm. I understand that they're making a lot of money, but I don't think that they feel eventually that great about themselves afterwards. I think they have a lot of pain inside when there's that, like, and I don't even understand, but I don't know. I know that my goal for my daughter is to give her self-esteem and to know that beauty is important, but it is not the most important thing, and it does fade. And you have to know who you are. It's corny, but like, what's inside you? Beauty from the inside, and to own who you are and own your beauty. And like, she's a girly girl. We love to do girly, girly things, but that's not all you're about.
Right, right. I do tell people too, because often college students will ask me, how'd you get into writing, or how did you make some connections in the food world and whatever? And I'm like, you just have to advocate for yourself at this point. Like, you're your own brand and you're your own person. You're going to advocate for yourself. Like, no one's going to hand anything to you, because I feel like too, people see things on social media that, like, say I'm doing something cool. Like this past week I met Gordon Ramsay. So I put that on my like social media, and they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. But as if it didn't take like 7 years of hard work to get to that point. And they're just like, hey, how can I do that? I'm like, well, you know, you have to take the steps. So I think just advocating for yourself and understanding the image that you're putting out.
100%. And showing up, working hard, being consistent, and not being afraid of rejection or failure. I think people don't start because they're afraid of it can fail. I mean, I had restaurants that fail. I had restaurants that failed that shouldn't have failed. I had restaurants that succeeded despite thinking that they weren't. Like, there's sometimes also an element of life and luck that happens to things that you have no control over.
Yeah, a lot of timing.
The only control over you have is, you know, yourself, how you feel about yourself, the integrity that you carry with you, and the good that you do along the way. And also really, oh, this is a good one. I know we're over, but
no,
women in particular, I believe, I don't know if it's a scientific fact, but I really do believe that we are much more intuitive
Oh, I do too. Yeah, I believe that 100%.
And I think that when I look back in my 20s, in your age, like all the mistakes that I made, I intuitively was like in my gut, I was like, oh, even though like this guy wants to go out with me or this deal looks so amazing. Mm-hmm. And like, and I was like, but I was just like, I knew like something was so wrong about it. And it was, I was always, my gut was always right. So now instead of like suppressing it, I really listen to it. Like I really respect my intuition. And like, if it just doesn't feel right, even if everything's saying that it's right.
Yeah. And in the times that I've ignored it, I've regretted it. So I've.
Yeah. Right. Like it's all like, we all say the same thing, like trust your gut, be patient, be kind to yourself. I think we're really tough on ourselves.
For sure.
We're very critical of ourselves and go for it. And anything that you can't not do anything. Like I've always, thank God my dad gave that to me. He was just like from a very young age, he said, it was the defining moment in my life. I don't know if you have time for this last story, but when I was in the first grade, they had reading groups that was not politically correct because the reading groups were called the Swans and the Turtles.
Okay.
So you can imagine who the Swans were and who the Turtles.
And who the Turtles were, yeah.
And I was the classic kid that had undiagnosed ADHD, and I was like, bored and sitting. I went to this Catholic school with this crazy nun. Like, I had some good nuns, but this one was just not nice.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I remember being called into, like, the psychology office because I was failing first grade. They did a test. And I remember thinking, this woman, like, thinks I'm dumb. Like, you know, like, and I was this painfully shy girl. And my parents were called in, and my father never showed up to anything. Like, he worked all the time. So the fact that he was called in, I was like, this is something bad is going on.
Yeah.
And he came out very angry. And basically what they told him was that she spoke like an immigrant and talked like one too. And not to expect too much from her. I was basically slow and like I should just not even go to college and blah, blah,
okay,
blah.
Okay, being an immigrant and being slow does not have
I understand, but like talk about like the ignorance of that.
Yeah,
you know,
that
because
is-
there's a lot of people prejudiced Italians, you know, when we were younger. When my mom came here, they put garlic on her neck. I mean, they criticized her. So thank God my dad was like this proud Neapolitan, and he told her off and said, like, my daughter's like arguing with me and maybe you don't know what you're doing. And thank God, because many immigrants of that time would often take what the teacher said and like that was it. And he came home and he got on my level, very different than today. We'd be like, let's get a tutor and let's have a therapist, have a guided discussion.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm like, what's the matter, Dad? He's like, they said you're stupid. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, and what did you tell him? He's like, I told them that you are the most beautiful, the smartest girl I ever know, and that you come from the most beautiful culture in the world, where we created the best food and the best artists and the best this. And he's like, and I remember like just feeling in that moment, like, I could do anything. And it changed my life. The next day I went into school and I was like, I want to be tested for the higher reading group. And I got tested and then they advanced me and I graduated valedictorian. But it was and it was harder for me because I was ADHD. But I just had this thing that he said I was smart. I could do anything I wanted in life. And that was it. And that moment, you know, and it could have gone another way, right?
You love to prove people wrong, though. You said you were the valedictorian. You put them wrong in spades, my friend.
Yeah, but it was just like a beautiful moment. And I'm so conscientious of the power of words to children and how it defines them, you know? It's just, or it's even to you or to people that I know right now that I mentor in my kitchen. Like, you know, I have young kids in my kitchen that are, you know, that are often overlooked or not, or neglected, and I take them, and I just really like to the women, all the ones that are often overlooked. The kitchen's a rough place.
It is. I've heard many stories of it, but I feel like my parents really cultivated a good.
I think so. You should be very proud of yourself.
Thank you. But they really never told me I couldn't do anything. They weren't necessarily, or they aren't necessarily risk takers themselves. And I think they would agree with me saying that. But I've never really been afraid to take risks because I think they've cultivated an environment where they were like, you're powerful and strong and beautiful and you can do literally anything you want.
Yeah, and you're young. Now's the time to take the risks. Don't do it when you have three kids and a mortgage.
Yeah, I have no responsibilities. I do have my rent, which really stinks, but yeah, right now I'm doing okay. But I think you just have to tell yourself that too, because it's so easy to just fall back into old patterns of thinking you're not good enough or thinking you can't do something because people tell you you can't, you know?
Never listen to what people say.
It's easier said than done, but
I really try not to at all. I try to invoke the respect and take information from people, but still at the end of the day, it's my decision. Even if I respect their decision, I still have to like follow my, you know, my heart. And I think, like I always say, what is the worst that can happen? And like, you have to play that out. Like, right. If you are like, if you do have kids, like you have to like modify how you do things. If you want to start a business, you can't just quit your job and blah, blah, blah. But like, what is the worst that could happen? If you failed, you will learn something so valuable, and probably something else even better will come out of it. Because every failure has led me to, you know, greater successes too. And
plus then you know that that won't work. Like you'll never wonder, you know? So it's just like every stepping
stone. You never want to live with regret. To me, that's like suffocation. Like the coulda, shoulda, woulda. Don't have time.
I gotta say, with your impressive resume, you definitely did so many things that you should be proud of. And I think you are.
I really appreciated this time, and you better come to Miami. We'll make some meatballs together, some pizza.
Please. And if you're ever in LA, you don't have a restaurant in LA, right? It's just New York.
No, but I come there sometimes when I film with Guy Fieri for Guy's Grocery Games or stuff. So I'm sometimes.
Just casually when she films with Guy Fieri. I love him. He's very nice.
He's really nice. Really good guy. And the whole team there are super professional. He's really impressive what he's done. He was a star from the beginning.
He really was. Yeah. I interviewed him maybe a few years ago now, and he like wrote down my Instagram account. Like he was just like so nice and willing to hear everything. And I love his shows too. So he's always been born a star, and then everyone dresses like him now.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny.
It is really funny.
Are you happy in LA? Are you staying?
I am. It's been good for now. I'm not sure how much I like California. I'm not sure how much I'll stay in LA. Maybe in my later 20s or something, I'll leave. But right now it's really good for my career, and I love being outside and stuff. So it's really nice weather. So I'm never going to be sad. But Miami's nice too.
Yeah.
So you can keep up with Donatella on Instagram at Donatella Arpaia, or on her website, donatella.com. And visit her at Noma Beach in her lovely restaurant, and I will be there too eventually.
Yes. Wonderful.
Hey, fellow foodies. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at livinforfoodpod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.